Okay, so thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon and give a colloquium at U of T. I think I've come here many times over the last perhaps 25 years. I had old friends who have since retired, and I have new friends who are here. So today I want to talk to you about skirmions in chiral magnets. And I remember when I was a beginning graduate student, I would often go into colloquia not knowing what the title meant and come out of colloquia in pretty much the same state. So I assure you that, the graduate students that is, that that won't happen to you, okay? And you can hold me to it at the end of the talk. And please feel free to interrupt me anytime during the talk, okay? Even if we can't get through everything, that's not a big deal. Right. So skirmions, as I will describe to you through much of the talk, are spin textures that happen in magnets. But I think I'm just giving you on this slide some of the big motivations for why anybody might be even interested in thinking about this topic. So one is there's been a huge amount of activity in various parts of the kind of science that I do, condensed matter physics, and its intersection with topology. And I hardly need to motivate that, given that David Thouless, Mike Koslitz, and Duncan Haldane just received the Nobel Prize this year precisely for doing early work which spearheaded this intersection of these two fields. Okay. The other very interesting things about skirmions is that these are long wavelength structures. And usually, long wavelength structures are things that people study in soft matter, like liquid crystals and so on. Except that this is happening in a correlated quantum material. So there's some, I'm going to be using techniques which people have worked a lot in liquid crystal world, but bringing it to bear upon quantum materials. And finally, as you will see in the rest of this colloquium, there have been beautiful new experiments. So this is not just pictures of the kind I'm drawing here. There are very interesting and many ill-understood, unusual electronic properties. And there's also, at the other end of the spectrum, a huge potential for application. So this is what I will try to communicate to you during this talk. So here's the outline. So let's first start with understanding what is a chiral magnet. Okay? So we all know what a ferromagnet is. It's a system in which the spins all align in the ground state to give a net magnetization. And the simplest theoretical description we can have of this is just nearest neighbor exchange couplings with ferromagnetic interactions, S1 dot S2. And these short-range interactions conspire to give you this beautiful long-range order, okay, that you see here. The negative sign here tells you it's a ferromagnetic interaction, so when spins are aligned, you get the lowest energy. But what I want to focus on is not just magnets, but magnets which have some chiral textures. So these could mean that the spins organize themselves into spirals or into more complicated spiral textures, which I will describe further, called skirmions. Now, obviously, if I have such simple interactions, I'll never get such textures. So at the very least, I need to have additional interactions in my system in order to get ground states in which you have structures with handedness, right? Because all of these structures, as you can see, have that. This can happen in a variety of ways in different situations, but I'm going to focus on one on which there's been a huge amount of activity in recent times, and that's systems which have this unpronounceable interaction called the Zhalushinsky-Moria interaction. Okay. So one way to think about it is as follows. If we write down a term which is the dot product between two spins in a Hamiltonian, then why can't we write down a term which is simply the cross product, S1 cross S2? And your first objection would be S1 cross S2 is a vector, so it cannot enter into a Hamiltonian. So I say, well, we'll dot it with some vector, D. Okay, now it can appear in a Hamiltonian. But the minute I write such a term down in a Hamiltonian, I actually learn something, that this gives rise to material constraints. This cannot just arise in any magnet. First of all, the very fact that in my magnet I have a vector D defined okay, means that I must have broken inversion symmetry. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to define such a vector in the first place. And secondly, as soon as you have a term like this, it means that there is a direction in spin space, okay, which gets correlated with a direction d in real or orbital space. So underlying such a term must be spin-orbit coupling, which is a relativistic effect which you learn about in your quantum mechanics classes, but one which also plays a crucial role in these magnetic spin textures. So, okay, if we buy into this, that I have these two terms, then what does that give rise to? So let's look at that. So if I have a dot product, we all know that's a cos theta. So if I have two spins which are neighbors, and then I twist them with a relative angle theta between them, the energy cost that I will pay will go quadratically in the angle between the two spins. On the other hand, the dm interaction, it has a sine theta because it's a cross product, so it's a linear. And we all know since childhood how to minimize a function which has a quadratic term and a linear term. And the answer is not at theta equals zero, which is where ferromagnetism would have said no angle between spins. But you immediately see that the spins like to actually form an optimal angle at which they twist relative to one another. And then this twist will persist in the lattice. And the characteristic angle is given as the ratio of d over j. So this is what, in the end, leads to the formation of spin textures. And because spin orbit coupling is a relativistic effect, at least in the materials that we will be thinking about, d is small compared to the magnetic exchange j. So this is a tiny angle. So the length scales over which the spins will tumble will be huge compared to the underlying lattice spacing of the crystal. Okay? And for future reference, bear in mind, again, just from this minimization, that the energy gained by having this twist is going to be d squared divided by j. Okay, now it's time, now that we know what a chiral magnet is, it's time to tell you what a skirmion is. So the strange name comes from Mr. Skirm, who was a British physicist who used, I think it's the first use of a topological soliton to model a particle in quantum field theory. And if you don't know what a topological soliton is, I'm going to try and explain that as well. But I think in the end, his work has what perhaps more impact in condensed matter physics than it has had in nuclear and high energy physics, even though I do know a lot of people still talk about Skirm's original work in those contexts as well. So I'm going to talk about skirmions and condensed matter. Now, the very first paper of skirmions and condensed matter physics was actually written by these two very well-known field theorists, Belavin and Polyakov. And they just said these are metastable excited states of ferromagnets. Because I guess Polyakov was particularly, I think, inspired by Berezinski's work, who did not share the Nobel Prize with Kostelitz and Thouless because he died very young. Okay, Polyakov was inspired by Berezinski's work on topological defects in condensed matter physics and was then beginning to think about topological objects in field theory, which led him to instantons and many of the other things that Polyakov is so well known for. Okay, and then in condensed matter, skirmions have somehow come to prominence in a very large number of systems, superfluid helium-3, liquid crystals, quantum Hall effects with spin. There are proposals to see them in systems with cold atoms. Actually, Arun is involved with colleagues of mine in that. But what I want to focus on is topological spin textures in a chiral magnet. So let's start with a more familiar example of a topological soliton, a vortex in a 2D superconductor, a superfluid, which is also particularly timely in view of the fact that Kostelitz and Thouless's Nobel Prize was really related to this. So we all know what a vortex looks like. Even if one has not seen superfluids, one has certainly seen bathtubs and sinks. Yeah? Except this is a quantized vortex in a superfluid. Now, this has a topological stability. What does that mean? The order parameter of a superfluid is a vector, or it's just a complex scalar if you want, with an amplitude and a phase. So I can draw it as such. And you can make whatever local changes you want in this configuration, and you cannot get rid of the fact that the phase winds by 2 pi as you go around the center of the vortex. And that is its topological stability. And you also get, because of this phase winding in units of 2 pi, quantized vorticity in units of 0, plus minus 1, plus minus 2. You cannot have half a vortex, okay? You can have none, or a vortex, or an anti-vortex, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that you get integers here, mathematicians, topologists would use homotopy theory to say something which you don't need to worry about if you don't have never heard of it, which is that the homotopy group of S1 is Z, which is the winding number, the number of time the vortex winds around. Okay, so now that we've seen that topological soliton, let's turn to the problem at hand. Okay, here I'm going to talk about the magnetization vector, M of R, at various locations in two-dimensional space to begin with. I'm going to say that the amplitude or the magnitude of this vector is fixed. So I'm only going to focus on the direction of this magnetization vector. And now I'm thinking of a magnetization which at the origin is pointing down, and as you come out towards larger distances, eventually at sufficiently large distances, the magnetization is always pointing up. And you can think of this as a superposition of spirals, because no matter which direction you go in, it's going from up to down. And you can do it in any direction, and you'll see that if you superpose these spirals, as it were, you get this kind of a structure. So this looks like a strange structure. It's not obvious. It's interesting. One reason why it's interesting is because it looks like a hedgehog. Why does it look like a hedgehog? It certainly doesn't look like a hedgehog when I look at it in two-dimensional plane, but if I identify the point at infinity, then the two-dimensional plane looks like a sphere. And if I look at what the spins are doing on the sphere, then you can see that the spin at the origin maps to the south pole in the sphere in spin space, and this texture actually wraps the sphere. And this certainly looks like a hedgehog, okay? And this can then be actually used to define a topological charge, much as we had a quantized vorticity. So the mathematician would say, consider maps from the two-dimensional plane R to the vector M of R. So these are maps from real space to spin space, okay? And then you ask yourself, in this map, if you identify the point at infinity, because after all these spins are up anyway, so they all look the same, sufficiently far away, how many times does this map wrap around the unit sphere in spin space? And then you can write down this formula, which may look a little bewildering, but it's actually not that hard. In fact, the integrand, m dot partial xm crossed with partial ym, is actually somehow related, if you do the math, and any one of you can sit down and do it, to the solid angle that this little patch subtends on that. And that's why you have this normalization by 4 pi. So if you look at this object, this looks like a strange object, but it turns out to be an integer. It can be nothing but an integer, 0 plus minus 1 plus minus 2. And the homotopy theorists would say that pi 2, the second homotopy group of S2, the sphere in real space, is 0. Okay, so as I said, this Kermion number, which is the integral of this object, is an integer. Okay, it's a topological invariant. And much like the vortex case, I can make local changes to the spin pattern in some region, and I will not undo the fact that when I integrate up that object, even with all the local changes made, I get an integer. I would have to make a global change to change the integer value. So why is this called a topological invariant? Well, the simplest example of a topological invariant, one of the oldest, is the celebrated Gauss-Bonnet theorem of differential geometry, where they said that if you look at the Gaussian curvature and integrate it over the entire manifold, suitably normalized, then you get an integer which just counts the number of holes that you have in the system. So it seems kind of strange. This is why topologists say that a coffee cup is the same as a donut, or an orange is the same as a star fruit, the local curvature here and here are very, very different. But if you integrate up the curvature over the entire manifold, it'll just tell you that you have no holes in these two, you have precisely one hole in this one. So it's in that sense that this Kermion number is also a topological invariant. Okay, and then you have different kinds of Skirmions. Either you can have hedgehog-like Skirmions or you can have vortex-like Skirmions, depending on whether the spins tumble like this or whether they stumble like that, and so on. And then you can also make Skirmion crystals. Now, I'm sure there are experimentalists in the audience who say, stop, okay? This is some theorist who is going berserk with, he obviously can either make very good pictures or his students can make very good pictures. But what does this have to do with reality, right? So obviously I should answer that question next. I should talk about real materials where all of this actually happens. So let me turn to that. Okay, so as I said already, one of the key ingredients required is a broken inversion symmetry. So let's look at situations where you have a bulk inversion which is broken. So R vector going to negative R is no longer a symmetry of the problem. So it turns out, after the 230 space groups, 65 of them actually break a bulk inversion symmetry. So this is not such an uncommon thing in nature. So here's an example of a non-centrosymmetric crystal, which means one which breaks bulk inversion. It's called the B20 structure. There are many examples, metals like manganese silicide, iron germanium, insulators, which has rather more complicated chemical formulas like copper, oxoselenate, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But so these non-centrosymmetric crystals break bulk inversion. And obviously they have transition metals like manganese, cobalt, iron, et cetera, et cetera. So they have the possibility of harboring magnetism, and these are all magnets, metallic magnets or insulating magnets. Okay, so then the question is, do they show interesting properties? And so here is the spin texture in manganese silicide probed by small angle neutron scattering. So here's a field temperature phase diagram. The zero of temperature is way down here, and there is this little phase here in field and temperature in which, when people do neutron scattering, they see six spots. So spots in neutron scattering give you, you know, these are Bragg peaks, so this gives you some ordering. And this ordering has nothing to do with the underlying lattice, because the length scale of this ordering is 200 angstroms, nothing to do with the underlying lattice spacing. So this actually arises from a hexagonal crystal of Skirmions. And you say, well, that's a story. It's obviously some hexagonal crystal, but how do I know it's a hexagonal crystal of Skirmions, okay? And then you say, well, the theorist told us so, and the experimentalist says, don't believe them, okay? So here are beautiful real space images by Tokura's group using something called Lorentz transmission electron microscopy, where they can go and measure and show you that you have an hexagonal crystal of Skirmions. Okay? And indeed, they can go in and zoom in on an individual Skirmion as well. And look at the size. This is like 90 nanometers or 30 nanometers, much, much larger than the underlying atomic space. Yes?
So what do they measure there?
Okay, so I'm a theorist, so let me give you my version of what they measure there. Okay? So this is an experiment done in transmission. So they take a single crystal, but they thin it down into a plate. Okay? They apply a magnetic field perpendicular to that plate, and this is transmission electron microscopy, so they shoot in electrons, then out come the electrons, okay? They look at the outcoming distribution of electrons to figure out the local magnetic fields that they traverse through inside the material. And from that, they're able to back off, if this is the z direction of the field, the motion of electrons is also in the z direction, they can back off mx and my, the components of the magnetization inside the material which are perpendicular to the z direction. And to the extent that at low temperatures, mx squared plus my squared plus mz squared is a constant, you've learned about what the internal magnetic field or magnetization is doing.
So this is
magnetization is actually what they're measuring, to be correct.
Yes.
they're actually backing out what the magnetization is by looking at the trajectories of the electrons. So as I said, we will see magnetic fields later on, but you can already see from this phase diagram that actually to see a skirmion lattice as opposed to other interesting phases such as helices and cones and so on, you actually do need to turn on an external magnetic field. It's only in an external magnetic field that you see this. Okay, that's an experimental fact. Okay, we can always add an magnetic field there. All I said was there were textures forming, but these are all textures, helical, conical, these are all textures. The interesting texture is this one because it has topological significance. Now it seems like this is such a minor, little, tiny part of the phase diagram. Why should I care? So before I answer that question, I also want to clarify one other thing, okay? That actually we know that this is actually a lattice of skirmion tubes in three dimensions. So that the magnetic field is the direction Z along this. And if you look at the XY plane, I see a skirmion lattice, but it's translationally invariant and ferromagnetic in the Z direction along the field direction. Okay, we know that from both theory and experiments. But now let me turn to the question that I had raised earlier. Why is this such a small region of the phase diagram? So that's not necessarily true. It's true that in bulk systems, the skirmion phase is this tiny region of field temperature phase diagram. But if you make a thin film, actually skirmions seem to fill up a huge part of the phase diagram. Okay. This is actually an insulating material, and there are some very interesting multiferrite properties. This is only for the experts. You can see this systematically also in this data from Tokura's group, from which I want to point out two things. First, skirmions are not a low temperature property. Here they're seen close to room temperature, and right now we have many examples which are happening at room temperature. Second, although this may be hard to read at the back, as I change the thickness from 75 nanometers to 60 to 35 to 15 nanometers, decreasing thickness, ever larger regions of the phase diagram in field and temperature which are occupied by the skirmion phase. Now the next question is, okay, so this is a very strange phase of matter in which the spins organize themselves in this way. What is it good for? You know, does it do anything interesting for you? Okay, so I won't talk about multiferricity in insulators, but let me talk about what happens in skirmion phases in metallic systems. So you get very unusual properties in metallic magnets. So here's the point. In the metallic magnets, there are core spins that form a skirmion lattice with these strange tumbling long wavelength structures. Now the conduction electrons move past the skirmion lattice. As the conduction electrons move past the skirmion lattice, they actually acquire what's called a Berry phase. Okay? And the equations of motion of the conduction electrons as they go past these objects actually looks like emergent electromagnetism. So it's as if the electron was moving in effective electric and magnetic fields. So in fact, for a 10 nanometer skirmion, the effective B, I'm just emphasizing that point, is actually gigantic, okay, 100 Tesla, right? And what these effective B fields do is give you something called the topological Hall effect. So in fact, this is the easiest way in which experimentalists, just by measuring the flow of conduction electrons in the background of a skirmion magnetization pattern, are able to say, here, I have skirmions in the problem. Okay. This is perhaps also for the experts, but actually in the same material, this is MNSI work by the Munich group of Christian Fleiderer, there's an entire non-Fermi liquid phase which is very ill understood, and somehow skirmions are implicated in that as well. So I don't want to dwell on that in this colloquium, but there's all kinds of really cool stuff going on insofar as transport anomalies is concerned. Now, how about if you're interested in applications? You say, okay, you know, if you go down to millikelvin, you get non-Fermi liquid phase, but what is it going to be good for? So even those guys are satisfied by, or seem to be satisfied by, skirmions. Okay, if you go to applied meetings and so on, there are entire sessions on using skirmions for applications. This slide is something I've borrowed from experimentalist friends and I myself am a little less knowledgeable about. But here goes anyway, some of the facts I do know. So one of the things that people want to do in the magnetic memory business is to flip spins by passing currents. And the way in which you flip spins, you have to move a domain wall between up and down spins. And these domain walls tend to get pinned. And it turns out that there are some well-known critical current densities for moving domain walls or deepening domain walls. It so turns out that the critical current density for deepening skirmion lattices is 5 orders of magnitude less than for moving domain walls. In some sense, the skirmion lattice is a very soft material which is sitting inside this hard condensed matter block. And to move it is very easy. So you, with rather low dissipation, you might be able to do what you want to do. The spin polarized tunneling STM experiments for reading and writing single skirmions. And actually, there are apparently quite serious proposals for using skirmions for memory purposes. So you would just store a classical bit, one or a zero, by the presence or absence of a skirmion. And here are some references along those lines. So somehow this field seems to have garnered interest from people who are interested in field theory, topology, all the way to actually making memories. Now, I talked about one class of materials, which is B20, which have broken bulk inversion symmetry. But actually, there are many, many classes of materials which have broken surface inversion symmetry. And I'm going to just go through this. The slide is for experts, but what is the point that I want to communicate to a general audience? Okay, if I make a thin film, I make it on a substrate. I don't need any broken bulk inversion or some fancy crystal structure. If I look up, I see one material. If I look down, I see another material. So Z is not the same as negative Z, and therefore I will break a surface inversion symmetry. And that surface inversion symmetry is actually, in and of itself, good enough to give you skirmion physics, and there's a huge number of systems, some of which have just been appearing in the last few months and days, where people have exploited this to get skirmions. Okay, now, next I want to move to some of the things that we have been doing. So if there are some questions about the general setup, then this would be a good time to ask them. Yes, please.
So far you look at the two-dimensional systems.
Not always. Bulk, MNSI is a bulk single crystal. It's not a two-dimensional system. No, that was just a way of presenting things for a general colloquium, okay? But anyway, think about it this way. As I said, in the real material, okay, you get skirmion tubes, okay? So insofar as the topological invariant is concerned, it's perfectly good to get away with taking a slice and saying that's a topological invariant.
You look at the cylindrical geometry and look at the slice.
Yes. It's much the same way as I introduced a 2D vortex, but you know that in a three-dimensional superconductor, you get a vortex line.
But if you are between two materials, it's somewhat different.
It could be. So boundary conditions could change the nature of the topological the spin structures and so on. Yes, indeed. Yes. Okay, so you're worried that how do you introduce the first skirmion into the system? Right. Right. So the thing is, as with, so how do vortex lattices in superconductors form? So yes, there are barriers to introducing them, but once you introduce them, they're there. So look, the point is, you know, real system, there are always boundaries, edges, that's where they enter from. So you know, they find their way in, one way or another.
Sorry, this is by looking at a field wall.
Say again.
Putting the material into the magnetic field.
Yes.
Yes.
But, well, that's one way, but that's not by any means the only way. If you look up that paper on reading and writing skirmions means you use a spin polarized FTM tip to actually write a skirmion. Boom. So you can make it enter right there by putting in a very strong local field as well. So there are, you know, there's no universal answer to how this happens, but there it is. Skirmion and anti-skirmion, is that what you want to say? I don't know of such situations having been done, no. But that doesn't mean that that cannot happen. But I don't know of an experiment purpose people have done that. Okay, good. Okay, so if they're so good, we should figure out ways of making them more stable over greater ranges of the phase diagram. At least that's how, actually the way I got into this is kind of very complicated and indirect, but we don't need to worry about that, but that's at least the way I can present it now. And that's always the way in science. You get in one way and then you make up a story about. Okay, so prior to our work, people had really studied broken bulk inversion in great detail. So there's pioneering work of Bogdanov and co-workers on that. And our work, which I'm going to present, is actually related to the broken surface and mirror symmetry and its importance. So this is work done by my present graduate student, James Rowland, my ex-postdoc, Sumilan Banerjee, who is now at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and my ex-graduate student, Anuratan, who's about to make a transition from Rutgers to Max Planck. Here are some references. Of time permitting, I might show some work in progress as well. Okay, so I already said that the form of the DM interaction is D dot S1 cross S2. And I also indicated that symmetry should dictate the direction of the DM vector because it's the broken inversion that gives you DM in the first place. So it turns out that if you have broken bulk inversion, the DM vector actually is just the unit vector, or at least its direction, is just the unit vector that separates these two spins. But if you have broken surface inversion, then the DM vector has this more complicated structure, Z cross R. So you might say, how do theorists come up with things like this? So let's look at this, okay? So for instance, if I'm looking at two spins, and I suppose I have broken surface inversion where Z doesn't look like minus Z, your first instinct is put Z hat here, right? Now there's a problem. Why is there a problem? Because if I interchange S1 and S2 in the Hamiltonian, it shouldn't matter. But in the cross product, they change a sign. Very bad, right? So as I interchange 1 and 2, dij must also pick up a minus sign. And the only way it can do that is you have it as z cross rij, et cetera, et cetera. Arguments like that tell you that this is the only thing that can happen. Now, these are very long wavelength structures. So actually what we're going to do is we're going to write down Ginzburg-Landau theories. And if you want to glaze over the formulas, glaze over them. It doesn't matter, okay? So it's just that this is the sort of physics that Degen and others use for liquid crystals. That's the kind of thing we're going to do. We're going to say, well, we're going to make a continuum approximation because, you know, the skirmion length scale is tens of nanometers, maybe 100 nanometers, okay, much larger than the lattice spacing. So I'm going to write down a continuum field theory. And then the experimentalists or students who don't want to look at these horrible formulas can just look at this list here. What are the terms we need to put into our theory? We need ferromagnetic exchange, because if you don't have ferromagnetism, there's no magnetism. Then we are going to put in two kinds of DMIs, or Jaloszynski-Moria interactions. One related to broken bulk inversion, which I call Russell House for historical reasons. The other related to broken surface inversion, which I call Rashba for historical reasons. And here I just put in a Zeeman coupling field. Now, there's one additional term that I haven't talked about at all that one needs to add, and is very important. It's just magnetic anisotropy. It's just simply there in any real material, and not putting in there would be a mistake. So let's have a short digression on this anisotropy. Okay? So that's a term in the free energy or in the Hamiltonian or what you will, which goes like plus A mz squared. So if A is positive, then I would like to make MZ as small as possible in the energy. Okay? So that means I have an easy plane in isotropy. I want the magnetization to be in the plane. On the other hand, if A is negative, I want MZ to be as large as possible. So negative A is an easy axis in isotropy. Where does A come from in nature? And the answer is it comes from many different sources. Okay, it comes from single ion, dipoles. But it so turns out that there is one piece of A which people have been kind of quite careless about in the literature. And it has the same origin as the DM term. Okay, and so you must keep it. Now, the reason why people have been careless about this piece that comes from the same origin as the syn orbit coupling of the Jalushinsky-Moria term is because they said that if you do a microscopic calculation, you can see this from Moria's original calculations, that this anisotropy is second order in spin orbit coupling squared, so it's much smaller than the DM term, which is first order in the spin orbit coupling squared. Wrong. This is correct, but to ignore it is wrong, and the reason is I already told you that the energy gain from the DM term was second order in d squared over j. So the energy contribution of this Compass-Kitaev term is exactly the same order of magnitude as the Jalushinsky-Moria term. So my coworkers and I showed that actually if you look at it in the correct dimensionless ratios using some microscopic quantum calculations, that for a very wide variety of exchange mechanisms, both in metals and insulators, actually this term is very important because it has essentially the same magnitude as d squared over j as shown in here. Okay, very good. So now we have everything in place. So as theorists, we're going to write down a dimensionless field, a dimensionless anisotropy, and just minimize the free energy that I had written down earlier. So it's actually a nonlinear sigma model for the field theorists because there's a constraint that the magnitude of this is fixed in space and to find the optimal. And we've done many different things. We've done variational calculations which are analytical. We've done numerical minimizations which are numerical. Of course, conjugate gradient methods. We also have some Monte Carlo. So let me show you the results just in terms of pictures. So what is it that theorists can say about this problem? So here is a phase diagram. And I'm going to look at the zero temperature phase diagram where actually skirmions should be hardest to see. So if I tell you that skirmions are present even at zero temperature, then that means they will certainly be present at finite temperatures. Okay? This is actually, we did it, but was also done simultaneously by Bogdanov's group. So here's the anisotropy. Positive anisotropy is easy plane. Negative anisotropy is easy axis. And there are many phases in the field anisotropy phase diagram. In fact, most of the phase diagram seems to be filled with this not that interesting spin texture called a cone texture, in which the spin is just, as it were, in space, rotating about the z-axis, the axis along which you have applied the field. And most of the phase diagram here is white, which is the polarized ferromagnet, the most boring state in nature, because the anisotropy says you should be perpendicular. Okay, the field says you should be perpendicular, so the magnetism says I'm going to be perpendicular. This is this, right? And in here is this little sliver where the skirmion shows up. Okay, we understand in detail why it shows up here. I'm not going into there. So down here at zero field, down here I get a spiral, which is like a helix actually here, which in magnetism is called a Bloch spiral. And here we get a hexagonal crystal of vortex-like or Bloch skirmions. One of them is shown here. Okay, so much for it. Now, how do we get skirmions to fill up more of the phase diagram than this? So one thing you can do is you can increase the contribution in the theory that comes from the Rushbaugh term, which is saying that increase the importance of broken surface inversion relative to bulk inversion. Okay? And when you do that, this is all drawn at the same scale, what you find is that the cone phase keeps getting eaten up and the skirmion and spiral keep growing into it. And you can understand that within the calculation as to why that happens. So what you find, again, these two phase diagrams are drawn on precisely the same scale, okay? So if you have the situation where you only have broken bulk inversion, here was this tiny region. But if you go to the limit where you have only surface or mirror symmetry broken, z going to minus z, instead of just this little sliver here, here's an entire region where you get a hexagonal skirmion crystal, that's the yellow phase. To boot, you also get a little sliver of a square skirmion phase, and the circular cone is just completely destroyed. So let me say a little bit about what we learn about the nature of the skirmions here. Okay? So first thing is that the nature of the spirals changes from a helical spiral to a cycloidal spiral. Okay? In a helical spiral, the spins are rotating in a direction which is in a plane which is perpendicular to the Q vector or the pitch of the spiral. In a cycloidal spiral, the spins are rotating in a plane which contains that Q vector direction. Okay? And then correspondingly, the skirmions also change from vortex-like skirmions, because this is a superposition of those spirals, to a hedgehog-like skirmion, which is a superposition of these spirals, if you wish. Okay? And many other properties also change in interesting ways. So let's focus on this Rashba limit phase diagram with only broken surface inversion. And what you find is that if you look at this region, which has been studied well before, it's on the verge of what has been studied well before, but actually for any region which is to the left of this line, H equals 2A, and I'm sitting at this point, then I get a skirmion crystal that looks like this. Now, one thing you see from the skirmion crystal is that if I look at the periphery of the unit cell of the skirmion crystal, I should have drawn a hexagon, but it doesn't much matter, then all the spins are up, okay? Since all the spins are up at the boundary of the unit cell, then these skirmions can exist as isolated excitations in a uniform ferromagnet. In other words, what I'm saying is, if you go to this phase boundary, which is between the skirmion crystal that I'm discussing, the yellow region, and the white region, such a skirmion need not just exist in a crystal as it does down here. As you cross this phase boundary, it could also exist as an individual skirmion here. And in fact, because all the spins are up, then all this business of, you know, homotopy theory and so on comes into play. So if you look at the topological charge density, which is this integrand of the skirmion number, okay, then what you find is that it's very concentrated right where the skirmion is formed. And in fact, in this calculation, the topological charge density, which is always negative, actually just adds up to negative 1. So it's a unit skirmion, if you wish. Now, as I change the ratio of H to 2A, things change a lot. Okay, so this is how the patterns seem to evolve, and this is how the topological charge density evolves. But something strange has happened in this So something strange has happened in pictures like this. So you can see that the topological charge density is not always the same sign as it was earlier on. Now, sometimes it's blue, which is negative, but sometimes it's even red. And in the square skirmion crystal also, the same is true. So it's as if the structure of the skirmion has changed as I have gone from H greater than 2A to H less than 2A. And now I have regions in space where you have this very weird picture showing up. Moreover, if I look at this configuration, the spins on the unit cell boundary are not even all up. Okay? So there's no way I could isolate a skirmion like this in a ferromagnetic background. Okay? And in fact, then, the only way in which to understand the quantization of this object is to actually use not homotopy theory, but something very akin to what David Thewlis got one half of his Nobel Prize for, the first Chern number. Okay, so this is the following statement. For homotopy theory, we said we could isolate a skirmion in a ferromagnetic background, and then we could wrap it up into a sphere, and we looked at maps from the sphere to the sphere. Now I can't isolate this skirmion, so I can't make it the system into a sphere. But what I can do is, I can say that the topology of the unit cell in real space is actually a torus, a two-torus T2, as mathematicians would call it. And I would have to look for maps from the two-torus to the two-sphere in spin space. And those have a quantized charge, if you wish, which is called the first Chern number. And so it's that which is giving us, despite the fact that there are regions in space where the density is positive and regions in space where it's negative, when you integrate it all up, it's always an integer, guaranteed by the Chern number. Okay, so this is probably the last technical slide that now, of course, in any real experiment, you would want to also figure out what's going on at finite temperatures, not just be at zero temperatures. And that's a rather complicated story for reasons that I don't need to go into. So we are collaborating with Monte Carlo experts, both colleagues of mine, Nandini Trivedi, and particularly Yingjie Cao in Taiwan. And we have some very nice results on finite temperature Monte Carlo simulations to look at the temperature field phase diagrams and the kinds of patterns that we see there. Okay, so since it's 5 o'clock, let me try and end. So conclusions. So hopefully what I have communicated to you is that this area of the intersection between condensed matter physics and topology is extremely rich. And what I have shown you, at least in the first part of the talk, are beautiful experiments with unusual electronic properties and very interesting novel applications. And in my own work that I talked about, I emphasized the importance of broken surface inversion, a particular kind of spin orbit coupling that arises under such circumstances called the Rashba spin orbit coupling, and going into a direction of easy plane anisotropy, which people had stayed away from because of their experience with bulk crystals, and predict a greatly enhanced stability of these fermions and the evolution of their properties. So thank you very much, and I'm ready to take any questions.